This episode is presented by New York Mutual Trading.
Hey there, HRN listeners. This is Harry Rosenblum, host of Feast Your Ears. I know that news about COVID-19 and the coronavirus has made a lot of people nervous about getting sick. This collective unease has already had a big impact on our restaurant and food communities, especially in New York's Chinatowns. We hope that now more than ever, our listeners will join us in supporting restaurants and the hospitality industry at large. Many of the restaurants we love are small, independent businesses. That means that even one or two bad weeks can put them in jeopardy of cutting staff, limiting hours, or even having to close for good. As long as we're still able, we should go out to eat and support our favorite restaurants. I think it's also great to remember that hospitality professionals are really good at hygiene and food safety practices. Long before there were guides all over the news about how to properly wash your hands, they were already experts at hygiene. Guests' health is tantamount to successful hospitality in any restaurant. And even if you don't want to go out, you can still support restaurants by ordering delivery, buying gift cards, and giving them some extra love on social media. What better way to handle a crisis than by supporting those in our own community? If we don't support them now, they might not be there when this crisis is over. Join HRN in supporting restaurants during this time, especially our friends in Chinatowns around the country. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief, with your hosts, Zara Tangora
and Bobby Conforto.
Hey, Mom.
Hey, Sauce.
Thought I'd take this opportunity to just remind our listeners about who we are. So we do this show about food and grief, and because I am a chef and you
are a bereavement and trauma therapist.
Right. So that is kind of where we intersect at food and grief. I also lost my dad a couple years ago and have had some really dramatic ups and downs in my 20s and 30s. And literal ups and downs, as you're going to hear about on today's episode with a very special guest. But just as a reminder of, you know, that is why we've started this show. We've combined our interests and professions together to bring you this show about food and grief. So on today's episode, we speak with a very old friend of mine, someone who I was with when basically, I was in a very bad accident, which was the catalyst for me being able to open a restaurant, which is the catalyst for, you know what I mean, the reason why I'm involved in food. Obviously, I had not been involved in food prior to opening my restaurant. And then through that,
it's how you turned the crisis into an opportunity.
Right. But so really everything that I do now in my life came from, in a way, I feel like it was one of those forks in the road where my life began again very significantly.
Pivotal moments.
A very pivotal moment, yeah. So today on the show, we have a good friend of mine. His name is Jeffrey Haynes. You might know him as Mr. Liff. He is a very, very, very well-known underground rapper. He is now currently working and touring with Thievery Corporation and is very involved in real estate, which is amazing. He talks a little bit about that at the end of the episode, but Jeff is a wonderful person and a wonderful friend and just like a deep, kind, genuine soul who I really love almost more than anyone else that I know in the world. Just a very deep love for that person. When you go through something like that, a near-death experience with someone, it definitely binds you forever. So
thank God you're both here.
I know. So we had a great talk with Jeff. He joined us by phone. He's in Rhode Island. But we loved it. I loved it. It was a great talk. So please enjoy your chat with Jeff. Jeffrey Haynes, we are here with Jeffrey Haynes on Processing, otherwise known as Mr. Liff, otherwise known as one of my oldest and really dearest friends, even though we don't get to see each other very often anymore. I feel like, Jeff, you and I have one of those friendships that is enduring, wouldn't you say?
It is enduring. You know, we've been, you know, ships in the night for a while. But I mean, you know, life goes that way. And I do find with, you know, some of the people I would speak the most highly of, that it just goes like this, you know, sometimes, you know, life takes you on different paths. And I mean, you've accomplished all these amazing things that I still need to just catch up on, you know, on, I mean, so much. I mean, just from Brucey on, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
and I mean, same for you. You're one of, I mean, everyone that I know knows you are. You're a very famous rapper. You're an incredible, do the rap music that the kids seem to be hipping and hopping to. Is that an accurate representation?
I must temper the very famous thing, you know, a little underground fame. You know, I've been independent my whole career, you know, and it's been a beautiful ride from being a soloist to being a part of The Perceptionist with my buddy Acrobatic to, you know, touring around the world with Thievery Corporation for the last 9.5, 10 years. It's, you know, it's been good to me, and I really can't complain, and it's actually surreal sometimes. But yeah, there's just so many, I'm just like in the midst of so many like epiphanies and revelations right now. It's really, you're catching me at a good time for a conversation.
I'm so glad, but this is going to be disappointing to everyone. I thought you were Eminem. So
No,
I didn't just see you at the Academy Awards a couple of weeks ago.
Never gone platinum or gold. Sorry about that. Not blonde either. Not blonde.
Oh well, not yet.
Not yet. Yeah, that's coming. That's never got some gray hairs creeping in. Gray hairs are creeping in.
So Jeff, you grew up in Boston, Massachusetts. During, like, let's say the 1880s.
It was actually the 1780s. It was an interesting time. I had the first what they called cell phone at that time. Yes, that was me.
It was just like two birds and a rock.
It was a two birds. Yes, you used it. Yes, it was two birds and a rock.
So what was it like? Tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up at that time. Like where you grew up, right outside of Boston, right?
Well, no, actually Brighton is a part of Boston, but it's just a part of Boston that has little to no notoriety compared to, say, Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan, or Boston proper, you know. So, it's just like this kind of like relatively sleepy residential area where there's like, you know, Boston College grad students or like post-grads, you know, probably like doing way too much work to try to get degrees and whatever it is, you know, and just, yeah, it was a really chill place for me. You know what I mean? Like, my first like real memories of being there are, you know, living in this big apartment building, you know, and just, yeah, the people upstairs for us were just very colorful people. Like, I can't even remember how many kids were upstairs, but just like, you know, you could just hear them run. They were bad kids, so they'd be running around every night. Their parents would be chasing them down, and you'd hear, you know,
you know, for sure.
back in those days, you know, like spanking your child was not as taboo as it is now. So, you know, you'd hear some ruckus up there, you know, and,
totally.
But no, it was great though. It was, you know, Boston's a great place, was a great place for me growing up.
Were your parents, you know, from Boston?
No, my parents are both from Barbados actually. Ah. So, when
did they come over here?
That's a good question. I think that they came over, I want to say 4 years before I was born. But although my mom actually came over way before my dad did. I just can't remember how many years she was over. But she originally actually landed in Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow.
You know? And then ended up, you know, I don't even know how she ended up in Boston. I don't know why people from warm weather places move to cold places like Boston.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Yeah, I've been trying to, like, why do New York and, you know, Boston and, like, Toronto have such large, like, West Indian, populations, people from the Caribbean? I don't know.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I have a West Indian friend who's from Grenada, and I should actually ask him that same question. I don't know. Maybe it's just an easy place to come to.
I think it's like
to immigrate to.
Yeah, I think it's also probably misinformation. Like someone just like lied collectively to everyone about the weather and just was like, you know, come up here, you know.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's just it's brutally cold in the winter. But hey, they, you know, my parents managed. And to add insult to injury, I played ice hockey when I was super young. So I had my two Barbadian parents at the ice rink, and one of the ice rinks was outdoors. So we'd be in Brookline at Lars Anderson Ice Rink at like 6 a.m., freezing cold. My two Barbadian parents just like freezing to death.
They're like, it's fine. It's not so cold if you stand in the sun.
Oh, yeah. They were hurting. But hey, you know, that's a testament to how much they love me. I got much love from my parents.
That's amazing. So, you know, we were kind of chatting a little bit before. I wanted to know more about like your food history and what it was kind of like growing up in your house. And you had mentioned to me some of your strongest food memories are from Saturday morning breakfast. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Haynes family Saturday mornings when I was growing up were legendary. There was, at the time, it was still called WWF. There was WWF wrestling on the screen. And best believe, after me and my mom and dad watched it, we would literally have brawls. Like we would practice out moves. You know what I'm saying? My dad was always the bad guy, and he was like not like a famous bad guy. He'd always be like someone that was like a total bum that was only put in the ring to get beat up, but was kind of okay. Like a guy like Johnny Rotts, like wrestling legend Johnny Rotts, who like never really accomplished it. That's who my dad's idol was. So it'd be me versus him. My mom would be the ref. You know what I mean? And she always had to intervene because my dad just used his size advantage, you know?
Yeah.
So
I love the image of your mom wrestling with you and your dad.
Oh, no. Yeah, she had to jump in there. You know, she had a limited skill set as far as her moves that she could perform, but she was an effective referee. You know, I didn't lose a lot of – you know, my dad lost a lot of matches because of disqualification.
That's amazing.
And that kept my record looking pretty good.
That's a tight-knit family, you know? It's really, it paints a good picture, though, of, like, what your family was like. And what kind of stuff would you have for breakfast?
Oh, my gosh. So my mom would be cooking, scrambled eggs. You know, at the time, you know, she was using Cheese Whiz back when, you know, we didn't know, you know.
Right.
Not the best thing to consume, you know, but there'd be eggs with Cheese Whiz and sizzling. And I just remember,
What's sizzling,
man? It's bacon that is without fat.
Oh.
So, yeah.
So it's just ham.
essentially, but in, like, a baconized form.
Yeah,
so
weird.
So we would eat that and have some waffles, or every now and then she'd make French toast, but the French toast was really nowhere on the radar. It was waffles, her scrambled eggs. The scrambled eggs were the highlight, and some sizzling. And I just remember the smell in the house. I remember, like, wrestling being on, Kung Fu Theater being on, Creature Double Feature, which was like, that's where I first saw like Godzilla versus Rodan. You know what I mean? Like just those ill monster battles, like Godzilla versus King Kong, Godzilla versus Mecha Godzilla.
Those are great films.
And then, yeah, amazing. And then, you know, and then like my dad would like at some point in all this would slip out the door, go to like the nearest record shop and come back with like a bag full of vinyl. So he'd have like a mix of like 45 records, 45s and full length albums. And he would just start DJing. He would just play
That's
all the hits,
so
you know?
Awesome.
So it was
That's
amazing.
Crazy.
Like, what a wonderful memory.
Yeah, that is. I mean, really, you're painting such a picture of such a special. It's like very cinematic, actually, the way you're talking about it. Like, and it's really an interesting relationship between, I think, parents that stay together and an only child, you know, and it can go all these different ways. Like, I know a lot of people who have parents that stayed together and they were only children and everyone was kind of isolated, but
lonely,
guys,
and quiet.
Yeah.
Right.
But you guys would seem like you really got into
raucous
it.
And
yeah, that's
we
fun.
Got into Exciting. It. I really feel blessed to have had those experiences, you know, because, you know, unfortunately later on in the story, my parents did split up, but I just think that my dad was like born to be a dad. You know what I mean? Like he was like fully signed up for this, you know, and he was just so into it. And my mom as well. And it was just really a remarkable adventure. I mean, you know, even when I, you know, got older, my dad was at, okay. So I was a year round athlete. I played, soccer, then switched to football. I played ice hockey in the winter, and then in the spring I played lacrosse. I was a lacrosse goalie.
Oh, hey, me I too. I played lacrosse too.
Okay, you know, it's a great sport.
It really
great
is.
Sport.
Yeah, it sure is.
You know, yep. I don't know if it'll ever make it big, but it's really a great sport to be a part of. You know,
it will not. It probably won't make it big.
Yeah,
even.
Yeah.
But
you
who
know,
knows?
My dad. Yeah, who knows? Who knows? But my dad probably only missed 3 of my games in like my whole career of being an athlete,
That's
you know, so
sweet.
Very dedicated.
That's when awesome. Did you start playing music?
Music came into my life. I mean, well, first of all, it was in my life as a kid, right? But I was just a fan.
Yeah.
And you know, I think, oh, I can't remember what, I want to say it was like 84 or 85. My mom gave me, it's like the only Easter gift I've ever gotten. My mom gave me a boombox and the Run DMC self-titled album in like 1985.
Wow.
And my mind was blown.
Wow.
That was like, you know, I had been listening to hip hop before that, but I think having that just took everything to a whole other level. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Having that cassette and like actually having my own sound system, you know, and I think from there, It just kept on growing, and I was just such a huge fan of hip hop for so long. And then I think that when I went to college, I went to college thinking I was going to be pre-med, thinking I was going to be a surgeon or something.
Wow.
And then, I totally thought I was going to. Then I quickly realized that I couldn't process information early in the morning. So I was like, okay, at 8 a.m. biology class was like a complete flat line for me. So I was like, I probably can't be a doctor. And that was when we're talking like 93 now. This is when I was just like, okay, well, what am I going to do with my life now that this whole thing about me getting into the medical field is not going to happen? And that's when I opened myself up to the possibility of letting my love for music just really overflow.
Wow.
And I just started to, you know, hang out with my only other two friends on the Colgate University campus that cared about hip hop enough to actually rhyme. So yeah. I would just hang out with my boys and rhyme and it was just, yeah, we you know, out of that, we carved 24, 25-year career in music out of that adventure.
It's really incredible. And then, you know, to kind of move it to the point when you and I met, I was a huge fan of yours when I was in high school, as was everybody I knew, all my friends. You know, we loved the whole underground hip-hop scene. We're all really into it, and the whole Def Jux thing was kind of just coming together at that time. It was, like, a really great time for underground hip hop at that moment. So we're talking the year like 2000. I mean, really from like 1999 on.
Yep.
It was really like popping off. And I met you at a show in Long Island called at this like little record store. I don't even know if it's still there actually, called the Cop Shop.
Oh my God, we met at the Cop
Shop.
We met at
the Cop Shop, yeah. And you were doing a show with Aesop, who is from my hometown and was definitely a hometown here at Aesop Rock. Great guy. And we met and we just like became good buds ever since.
We certainly did.
Like just real good buds. And you would come visit whenever you were in New York doing a show.
Yep.
And I would come to wherever you were, usually the Bowery Ballroom. I was just talking to someone last night. We were at a Music Hall of Williamsburg. Have you played a show there yet?
There's a Music Hall in Williamsburg?
It's called Music Hall of Williamsburg, but
I haven't played there yet,
It's the same people that own Bowery Ballroom. And so the sound is just as tight as it is at Bowery, and we were talking about old times, and I was like, yeah, I remember those old times and hanging out backstage at that like little cruddy backstage area at Bowery and watching your shows, and it was just like such a great time in life, and we just had fun and we were really good friends, and the point where you asked me to come on tour with you.
Yes, absolutely.
To
sell
merchandise and just basically pal around the country and world. We were supposed to go around the world, right? Wasn't it an international tour?
Yeah, it was supposed to. Well, that tour was national, but that was after years of hard work. That was my first tour bus tour where it was like the Mr. Lift tour. It was technically Mr. Lift and the Coup.
Yeah.
So we had East Coast and West Coast, but it was like I had finally, you know, paid enough dues to have a tour, you know, have my own tour bus, albeit in conjunction with the Coup, but it was supposed to be the start of some big things, and I was definitely, you know, very happy to have you on board, and I knew it would mean that we could get to hang out and also would put some money in your pocket. We would be out on the road making money together. It just seemed like a great idea, you know.
Yeah, and at this time I was 21, and how old were you? You were probably like in your late 20s or early 30s.
I'd say, yeah, I had to be. I can't remember what our age discrepancy
is.
I'm
36 now, and you're 45?
Right, exactly.
So you were like 29 at this time. I was 21.
Bobby,
let's bring you into the story because, you know, you're a huge part of what we're about to talk about. What were you doing at this time, Bobby, in the year 2005?
I was, when you went on tour, I was probably 2005. I was working at a World Trade Center program. It was right after 9/11.
Right.
And because what year was it you were talking about?
This was 2005.
I think it was. I think this is 06 though.
Oh right, it was
Zara.
When
we were on the
06.
Tour bus tour.
It was.
Yeah, because Momega was out, and I was touring the Momega album.
Right.
I was still working in a World Trade Center program. I had a private practice, and at the time that you flew out to go to California, I went to Florida to visit my mom for her 80th birthday.
Okay. Right.
Mm-hmm. So that brings us to
right. And so I fly to San Francisco. Now, I want to share a funny story that is somewhat food related about the beginning of this whole horror show of an ordeal that happened, which actually led to great things for everyone. But the beginning, yeah. Let's start at the beginning. So I'm 21. I'm definitely in my like doing drugs and drinking phase of my life. And so a friend mm-hmm. gives me, and I was terrified of flying. So a friend gives me a couple of Xanax and I take them on the plane going out to meet you in San Francisco from New York. And I drank like 3 Bloody Marys and passed out in the middle of the plane, like the plane seat. I was sitting in between 2 people wearing my big coat. And then I remember is waking up in the middle and like walking around and being like, Bloody Mary. And I was like, Bloody Mary monster just roaming around the plane. And I was told to get back to my seat. And then I left my license on the plane. And I remember that there was a big deal on the tour, me trying to get my license, because I think we had to go to Canada at some point, but I ended up never needing it.
Right.
Yeah. And so I met you in San Fran. And
sounds like a strong start
it
to
was
the touring
a great
experience.
Start. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and say I jinxed us. I'm just kidding.
right. Oh my God.
It wasn't your
no,
fault.
No. You didn't jinx. You didn't jinx.
It was somebody else's fault, but it wasn't your fault.
So I met you in San Fran. One thing that I always remember, Jeff, I don't know if you remember this, but when we were in San Francisco, I had never been before. And I remember I walked around by myself for a while, and then me and you got fried seafood together and clam chowder. Do you remember that?
Oh my gosh. It's somewhere in the memory banks. I need to hear you keep talking about it though, about the fried seafood. It's just like listening to a different life, because I don't eat, fried foods often at all anymore,
Well, I don't remember what you ate. You might have had a piece of broiled scrod.
I probably had the broiled scrod. Yes, I did.
I'll have the fried scallops and the clam chowder. My friend will have the scrod. Thanks.
The word scrod just cracks me up. It just sounds dirty to me.
Scrod.
Scrod.
Scrod is silly. So anyway, we were there. There we were. You were chowing down on packing your face full of scrod. And
I was chewing. Raw scrod, baked scrod, grilled scrod, all types of scrod.
Scrod
yeah.
milkshake. But I was, I remember that it was I remember so vividly what I ordered. I had fried scallops and I had clam chowder in a bread bowl, which is great because you can eat the bowl in any.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
No waste. But it was fun. And I just remember we just had fun. I felt, I was 21 and I felt like an adult. And I remember feeling really proud of you. And we hung out with like Aesop and a bunch of other people that night when we were in San Francisco. And I just felt. Like, it was just so fun. I was like, I remember even thinking then for my own part of it, I was like, I feel lucky to have this cool experience in my life. I'm a young kiddo. I'm out with my friend. He's like a really popular touring musician. And I just feel lucky to be having this experience. And I was so full of joy. I don't know. How did you
That's
feel
beautiful.
Going into
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was riding that wave too. You know what I mean? Because I can definitely say that, being a touring musician, there are times where you do succumb to the grind of it, right? Where you're just like, I've been in this, van for however many hours, and, you get bummed out. You do a bunch of consecutive dates, but I feel like I've been able to keep a pretty good perspective of just really appreciating it, because it could have not happened. What I mean? I could have just been doing, office work for the last, 20 something years or something like that, or just doing any type of work that didn't fulfill me as much. So I'm super thankful. And I was definitely riding that wave of being happy that you were there. Cause I mean, that's actually one of my love languages is like being able to build wealth with friends and include friends in my ventures that are helping us accumulate some money. So it's just a great time and you and I always had a ton of fun. I mean, always.
We did. Yeah. And then so we went down to LA after that, which is like fuzzy for me. I don't remember LA as much. And then the last day was in San Diego, and I remember we paddled around in San Diego, and it was a beautiful day, and I remember it was so fun and we had such a good time. And then we played a show at the House of Blues. We played a show at the House of Blues, and
terrible experience there. They treated us really poorly.
Yeah, I remember the experience at the House of Blues was really bad. Again, we were on tour with The Coup, who is fronted by Boots Riley, who some of you may know from the amazing movie he made put out last year or 2 years ago called Sorry to Bother You, which was incredible. He's gone on to do some incredible stuff. But do you want to tell our listeners, go on from there, what happened in the rest of the night?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I remember walking down the marina with you in San Diego. and us both being like, hey, why is the bus driver still in the bus? You know, like, he was awake, and we were not used to seeing him awake during the day, because typically on a tour, you know, the drivers drive through the night, and then they, you know, you reach the destination, and then they go to the hotel room, and they get some rest.
Right.
And I found it very, very odd that the driver was not sleeping during the day.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had this show at House of Blues in San Diego. They treated us like absolute crap. I was really, you know, I was pissed off, you know, pardon my language.
No, you can curse. You can even say scrod. You can say fuck. It doesn't matter.
Okay, yeah. I was fucking pissed. You know what I mean? We got treated like shit that day.
Yeah.
And I just remember, you know, our next show was like in Arizona. It was like Scottsdale or something like that. Mm-hmm. We're in San Diego. We only got a 6-hour drive, which is nothing in the course of a tour bus tour.
Yeah.
You know, and I just remember this hurried pace about leaving. And me just being like, why are we in a rush to leave? Like, this isn't even a long drive. And on top of that, I didn't see, I just remember being like, did the bus driver even rest, you know? And I just remember, you know, kind of, I one of our fellow musicians joining forces with the tour manager to tell me that, you know, the bus driver is a professional, and if he says he's ready to go and he can do it, he can do it. And just, you know, just kind of getting outnumbered on that.
Yeah.
And talked down out of my common sense abilities. And unfortunately, I mean, there's a bunch of, very unfortunate and also fortunate events that followed that, which were, you know, I was so pissed off after that show, my inclination was to go into my bunk and go to sleep. Or just go into my bunk, close my curtain. I think I had some book that I was reading, and I just wanted to block the world out because I was so upset.
Yeah.
But this would turn out to be a saving grace, at least for me. But the Clips had dropped an album called Hell Hath No Fury that night or that day.
Yep.
And also The Game had dropped his debut album. And,
right.
I wasn't up on The Game, but I definitely
The Clips record was absolute fire, though. When we were listening, we were obsessed with that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because the first album was crazy. I think it was the Lord Willin album was crazy, and then I was waiting for Hell Hath No Fury. So, you know, instead of like just staying in my bunk and like, you know, sulking, I decided to go to the back lounge where there were like maybe 3 or 4 members of our, you know, travel party. And they were bumping the albums, you know. And I just remember I sat there. I listened to everything. I listened to the whole Game album. I listened to all of Hell Hath No Fury. And, you know, it was only when the other people back there fell asleep in the back lounge. That was when I came to the front lounge to see what y'all were doing.
We were watching Anchorman.
Yeah, you guys were watching Anchorman.
Because we had just left San Diego. And I had bought fucking Anchorman at Tower Records. This really dates the whole situation. For $10 a DVD in their like $10 DVD bin, and we had happened to be watching it because we left San Diego. Otherwise, we would have been asleep too.
Exactly. And, you know, I remember coming out there and just being like, okay, well, you know, this looks like fun. I guess I'll hang out for a little while. And, man, I will never forget. I remember, you know, you asked me to pass you a beer out of the fridge. And, I handed you the brew and... You know, might have had time to maybe get one other chuckle out at the movie, and then I just felt the bus jerk. I thought to myself quickly, like, oh, we must be swerving to get around something. And then, you know, next thing I know, you know, it's pitch, there's just impact, you know, and blackness. You know, the lights are out. And, you know, I don't even know that I remember people screaming.
I don't remember that either.
Yeah, I just remember, like, slow motion. Like, I think I went into a state of, like, hyper-focus.
Yeah.
It was survival instincts definitely kicking in, but just trying to find a way to, I think, not get flung around too much.
Yeah.
I remember the big old school TV popped out of the console and bounced off my leg. I thought I broke my leg, you know, because I could like feel the bones bend, and I just assumed that my leg was at least fractured.
Right.
And yeah, I just remember, you know, the bus finally coming to a halt, and
did it
you
crash?
Know, we crashed. The driver, you know, I guess it came to our knowledge later that the driver fell asleep at the wheel.
Yeah,
because he did not sleep an adequate amount.
Yeah, you were correct. And it went off a, what we should tell everyone, it went off a 40-foot cliff in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, basically. And thank God. And the toughest thing for me in trying to get over that was I heard that there was like a 100-foot drop on either side of the part we tumbled down. And that was psychologically was probably the toughest thing for me to bounce back from for a while.
Wow. I didn't know that. But
yeah, we could very easily not be here. But, you know, I just remember, you know, the bus finally coming to a halt, and I just remember standing on top of a pile of rubble, like basically, you know, like I don't know how I kind of ended up on top of a bunch of things that had been thrown around. And then literally when the bus came out to a halt, my glasses fell off right in front of me.
Oh,
like,
crazy.
which for me was crucial, right? Because my eyesight's not that good. So if my glasses had flown off right when this all started, I probably would have gotten like beat up much more badly by things that were flying around.
Totally.
And I don't think that I could have been as useful to anyone after the crash if I couldn't see.
Right.
You know?
And you were so useful to people. I mean, you saved me. I remember you pulling me out, basically.
Well, Zara, I don't remember that part, but what I remember is the injury to your hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, us developing the idea that I should use one of my socks as a tourniquet.
Yeah, you did use your sock as a tourniquet.
Yeah. And I also remember, you know, Big Wiz, you know, my DJ at the time, he was also Aesop Rock's DJ. I just remember, you know, him being in a really compromising position and me not being able to help him.
Yeah, he was he was really stuck.
Yeah.
He did break his leg.
He broke, I think, he shattered his kneecap. He cut his head down to the bone.
Yeah.
I think he broke his nose. I just, Wiz is a big guy. And, you know, I think that with the combination of, I mean, really, I was overwhelmed. There was a point where I was overwhelmed with fear because there was a fire that broke out underneath the sleep area in the bus. And thank God no one was asleep in there.
Yeah, we would have been stuck in there, first of all, because the doors wouldn't open because those doors only open if the bus is on. So picture the fate of there being a 100-foot drop on either side, nobody being asleep in their bunks at 3 in the morning or whenever this happened. Everyone was not in the bunk. Not one person of all those people who were on the bus. What was that, 13 people? 12 people.
Something like that.
Everybody lived. Everybody got out. Even Wiz. And I'm not sure if you know this or remember it, but Wiz, who is a very big guy, was actually stuck on top of me when we crashed.
Oh, my God. I don't remember.
And
Now I remember this.
And I believe that you helped me get out from under him. And then I just remember seeing fire and being like, I don't want to. My most distinct memory of that is like, I don't want to feel myself blow up. Like, I don't want to like see this blow up and then experience the moment of those couple seconds when you know you're going to die and then feel myself on fire. Like, I just didn't want to feel that. It was so distinct. And my instinct from then was just like, get the fuck out of here. Like, we must get out of here. It was such a survival instinct. You don't even know you're hurt. You don't know your hand is bleeding. You don't know, right? Like, you just have this killer instinct to get out. And then we did get out and we walked up this hill. And I remember also during that point being really concerned about rattlesnakes. I was like, I really just don't want like a rattlesnake to bite me because we were like in the desert and I'm like walking on all these rocks. My toe ended up actually being sliced off as well. Got sewn back on. But then randomly some woman was driving by. We got in her car. You were with me. You're like helping my hand. And she drives us to this podunk little hospital in the middle of nowhere.
And that's when.
Oh, yeah. Bobby, enter the story. And then Jeff calls Bobby.
So just my little part of the story is I was in Florida visiting my mom. I'm in her apartment. 7 o'clock in the morning, the phone rings. And it's you, Jeff. And you say, there's been a terrible accident. Zara was hurt. And then the phone went dead.
Are you serious?
That's all I heard.
Yeah.
So we were about to take my mom for a birthday breakfast at this restaurant on the ocean down the road. So I didn't want to tell her that there was an emergency. I just figured I'll hold it in. And so we went to the restaurant and we're walking down these marble steps, and my mother drops on the floor and cracks her head.
Oh, my
gosh. And
there's
blood all over the floor. And at the same time, the phone rang again. And that was when I heard that Zara had had a very, very serious injury to her hand. It was called a degloving, where the, all the skin comes off the hand. And it was at the same moment my mother's lying on the floor bleeding. And talk about cursing. I ran into the street and just yelled fuck at the top of my lungs. I didn't know what to do. So pick it up, Sarah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've told this story a lot before, Jeff, and I know that you have too. I've read a lot of interviews that you've given talking about it, and I've talked about it a lot. But
talking about it with you and Bobby is a whole different experience.
Yeah, it really is, because it's like, it's so interesting. I think when you tell other people, it becomes almost like you're reciting a movie you saw. But then when you really talk about it with someone who lived through it, and like all three of us have had our different experience with, grief afterwards. It's just it's just really different, and it's healing in a way. And you remember things you didn't remember before. And this show is about the intersection of food and grief, and I'm going to tie that in the food element a little bit later. It is grief. It is grief when something like this happens, even when nobody dies, right?
It's trauma.
Because trauma, exactly. It's intense trauma. But there's so much loss there, right? Because, you're on the precipice of this incredible moment in your career where it's all just really ramping up. I'm a young woman, like, just excited to kind of start my life. And, it ended up being oddly enough, one of the greatest things that ever happened in my life and led me into my own career in food.
Crisis is both danger and opportunity.
Right. But the immediate, man, I mean, you literally just see everything burn away. All of your dreams, particularly you. You know, like, this was your thing. Mm-hmm. This was your tour. This was your moment. It was a very big moment. And I'm just, like, wondering for you, like, post-accident, where is your head at? Like, where are you grateful to be alive? Are you devastated because of what happened with the tour? Like, all of the above. Like, what is your feeling?
All of the above. I mean, the level of concern for everyone involved, just feeling terrible because it was my tour, and
did you feel responsible? Like, it was your fault?
I mean,
I don't feel that way, but I'm just curious if you felt that way.
If anything, my indelible lesson walking out of that was listen to your gut, because I knew something was wrong. I knew something was wrong. And I let people talk me out of it.
Yeah.
I
remember
if I had it my way, we would have never gotten on that bus that night.
Yeah.
It turns out, by the way, that the driver wanted to do the drive at that time because I think he lived in Scottsdale or wherever the next town was and just wanted to get home, And I also heard that he had been binging on drugs and prostitutes the night before, which is why he couldn't sleep during the day. So, insane. But yeah, for me, and I do want to talk with you, Zara, too, about what the toughest part of your recovery was. I think for me was all the feelings of, I mean, it was a smorgasbord of, like, guilt, just be like, oh my God, like, not even guilt, just remorse, just like, wait a minute, like, this was my tour, trying to take care of my people, and this thing just literally went up in flames. So there's, like, guilt, remorse, embarrassment, physical pain, and also just, it took a while for me to really firmly believe in the fact that I was still alive. Like, I literally just thought, I was just like, okay, like, am I just living this thing that I've seen in movies where I'm now just like, I'm dead, but I'm still connected to my prior life, and I'm just like hovering around as a ghost or something.
Yeah, I thought too.
Yeah. And and then, like I mentioned earlier, the toughest thing psychologically to get over were the what ifs. You know, what if we had gone off, a deeper drop, what I mean? And like, it just took a whole lot. And I think shortly after that, the bottom dropped out of the economy in the USA.
Yeah.
So it's just like, it was just this kind of like, it went from, all right, like, you paid all these dues, you've been putting records out since I think it was like 97, and you've done all these shows, and now you're finally, you're getting to this place, You know, and then it was just like, no, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Like, actually, you're in this position that you don't even know if you're going to bounce back from. And now the world around you, not too long after, is just kind of seems to be crumbling too. So it's just a really difficult time for me that you know, I kind of ended up being a bit of a wanderer after that, to be honest. I mean, I just remember like living in different areas. I was out in Seattle for a while. I was out in the Bay for a while.
Oh, right.
Like,
Just
kind of recording with different people with no real direction in my life. And it was just weird, man. It really took me on a very interesting path, you know?
You lost a lot of your belongings, right, in the crash?
Yeah, but you know, I don't even remember. I don't even remember what I lost. I remember probably at the time I was like, oh, no, my merch that I spent money on and, like, whatever else. But, you know, I'm just not a big material belongings person.
Right.
I think it was shock of being in that situation and just all the hard lessons that had to come with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not listening to my gut, there were just so many points where I was like, oh, if I had just done this a little differently or this, that, or stood up for myself.
Totally regret, total regret.
Yeah.
And over things you have no control of. I remember losing, obviously I lost all my clothes too, which who cares? But I remember that. Mm-hmm. I just want to give a shout out to LP, who owned Def Jux at the time. I remember one day I was at Bobby's house recovering, and like boxes and boxes of Def Jux clothes arrived. I was wearing like a Cannibal Ox sweatsuit for like 3 months straight.
nice. Ella's good peoples. You know, that's another person
kind.
I'm thankful to have in my life, and
he's
blessed me in so many ways, and he still continues to just great peoples.
Yeah,
man.
Jeffrey, I have a memory of chocolate. I think it was M&M's. Because whenever I'm really, really, really stressed, I have to eat M&M's. It's just something that I've always had. So what happened to me is I flew from Florida. I left my mom in a hospital, and I flew from Florida because I heard that Zara was being raced to a major hospital in San Francisco to have surgery. So I remember going through Houston. I never thought I'd be in Houston, Texas. It was the
George Bush Airport of all fucking places.
Yeah. And I remember buying several bags of M&M's. And then I remember coming to the hospital. It was part of University of California, San Diego
UCLA,
Hospital.
Yeah.
And I remember you hadn't gotten there yet. And I think we kind of came at the same time. We entered the hospital at the same time. And it was when I first saw Zara in bed, wrapped up in bandages, tubes coming out of her. And I remember sharing a bag of M&M's with you.
Aww.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Oh, my God, that's such a sweet memory.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so scary.
I bet. You know, it's just like, it is such a weird journey. And, like, for me, that's what led me to food. So I was lucky enough because I guess of the severity of my injuries to get some money, which also I want to address.
Well, first you had two surgeries.
That's true. I did have two terrible surgeries. And I remember at the time I was young and I had the same desire as you did, Jeff, which was to share things with my friends. And I was like, oh, I'm getting money and I want to give you some. And I never did. And I'm really sorry. And I didn't know in some ways what I was saying at the time or what I was promising or what I wanted to do versus what I should do. And if that was to happen now, I would have done it really differently. And if I wasn't so broke now, I would give you some money out of my wallet.
But
I'm just saying, I am sorry.
Totally
because
understood.
I did get money from the accident and I used it to open my restaurant, and I'm sorry that happened. And I just want to actually publicly address it.
And I'm so glad you did, you know, because I just think that, you know, it's important to bounce back strong. I mean, that's life, right? Like, life is all about how strong can you bounce back from getting knocked down.
Yeah.
I
mean, yeah.
You know, and
totally.
Yeah.
Sing it, Jeffrey.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No.
I'm saying sing it. That's so powerful.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. It's a real thing. And Zara, you know, it's very sweet of you to say that. But just know that there has not been any moment, you know, of I can't remember any moments of my life that I have, you know, spent thinking to myself, Zara should have given me some money.
Of course not. You would have never thought that. It wasn't about you. It was about me. It was about me going out of my way to mention it. You would never ask me for it. It was about me offering it and mentioning it mm-hmm. and thinking that I wanted to include you in the thing that happened to me that was beneficial, the same way you wanted to include me in the tour, is totally my idea. And then mm-hmm. not following through on it, it was something I always kind of really
well, I would like to
about.
Add that when we went to the lawyer, I remember speaking about Jeffrey and telling him about all his losses and what he had yeah. and how could he be helped. I remember trying to
yeah.
see what we could
it's
do.
It's so complicated in that
very
part
complicated.
Of time.
And honestly, for me, unfortunately, like I think I was just so shell-shocked because, you know what? If it was me on someone else's tour, I just think I would have been so much more proactive about getting more justice for myself.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But I think that because my name was, you know, on the banner or the marquee every night, I just kind of turtled, you know. I didn't fight for myself the way that I should have.
Right.
You know, there was bad information that I had been gotten. I mean, I just felt like there was a culmination of people around me at that particular time in my career that just, it was just like bad advice, misguidance, you know,
yeah.
it just all culminated into, it just felt like this disaster that I didn't even really, you know, I just never imagined something like that. I mean, I
yeah.
knew, you know, I had my gut instincts about, you know, not wanting to drive that night or whatever, but I mean, it just, so I... You know, I definitely am very happy that you went out and got what you deserved and that Big Wiz went out and got what he deserved.
Yeah.
You know, if I had it to do over again, I don't even know. Like, sure, I wish that I had been more proactive, but I don't know how I could have pieced myself back together to.
Right.
But I remember a terrible thing happened. What happened was is that we found out that there really wasn't sufficient coverage, that the only way Zara
right.
actually got money was through my auto insurance, believe it or not, my auto insurance, because
yeah.
she was a driver on my auto insurance, because that guy had a bad bus company or something. I don't know what it was, but
right.
there wasn't money there.
Yeah.
And that happens
oh
a lot.
God.
When people have accidents, we think, oh, there's an accident. We're going to. Zara had these surgeries and her hand was permanently damaged, but there was no money from that
yeah.
bus company.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Right.
It was a terrible situation
yeah.
altogether. So,
yeah.
question. Here's something mm-hmm. that I kind of was thinking through today earlier before we talked, and I want to know what you think about it. And Bobby, I
yeah.
have a question for you pertaining to this too about PTSD and how we cope. So the part of the reason, aside from the fact that I think you have an interesting family story and I love hearing it, that I wanted to kind of start with that, is that really your depiction of your Saturday mornings with your family is the definition of a happy place. I have mine. You know, I
yep.
have mine. My happy place when I have to think of the quote unquote happy place is the beach, Robert Moses Beach in Long Island, and walking up to it and seeing my mom get up from her chair and walk towards me and that moment and the waves and the chicken salad and everything. But
beautiful.
And maybe you have others, but correct me if I'm wrong. That memory of you talking about Saturday morning breakfast with your family sounds like a happy place. Is that true?
Man, that is the happiest place. Seriously. It's
yeah.
just. I mean, I will just cling to that. I mean, I'm just so thankful to have had that experience, you know, and that my mom is still alive today and still makes those amazing eggs.
That's incredible.
And now it's turkey bacon.
Okay.
Now it's turkey
okay.
bacon.
All right. So, go ahead.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and, you know, because I do travel quite a bit, like, you know, when I am, you know, we're based out of Rhode Island now. I moved down here and I, you know, actually started a real estate investment company. And basically now what I'm doing is, like, as I mentioned before, like my love language is like, is, you know, building wealth with my friends. So, you know, basically I invest in multifamily properties out here alongside my friends. And, you know, whether I'm doing like an equity partnership with a friend of mine or they're just lending on a deal and I'm giving them like a robust interest rate, like, you know, I've been able to do that. So that's been very heartwarming.
That's amazing. I'm so proud of you.
So proud of you. Yeah.
That you do that. That's incredible.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've always talked very much about that, though, about the value of owning property. That's
right,
something you've always talked about.
Well, I mean, after getting, you know, my ass kicked like so many other people did in the housing crisis, that was, you know, it was tough for me to be enthusiastic about it. But I definitely reeducated myself rigorously and jumped back in and just, you know, and I'm just like, you know what, I'm going to use the power of my knowledge in this business to help my friends. You know, because banks aren't looking out for us at all.
Absolutely.
They're giving us nothing.
100.
So, but I digress, you know, I digress. You know, I think that, okay, no, repose the question just so I can
My question really just actually is, so I'm like building up with like talking about how, you know, that memory seems like your happy place. And then, so where I was going to go with it from there is kind of just asking, how much did you access those memories?
It's called a resource.
Right. How much do you use that inner resource of that smell of the fatless bacon and the Cheese Whiz and the eggs and the wrestling and your dad playing records? Like, what kind of thing did that specific memory, or just memories like it, warm memories of family and food and sharing and smells?
Do they help you through hard times?
Particularly
this hard time.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember reflecting. What mattered a lot to me during that time, right after the accident, was that my mom came to Philadelphia, where I was living at that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was dating, you know, someone that was 10 years younger than me. Mm-hmm. Very sweet, amazing young woman. But she just was not nurturing in the ways that someone coming home from a harrowing accident needed. You know, so it's just like,
yeah, nobody's fault. Just that's like, wasn't her, that she didn't have the utility at that age, I bet.
Yeah. At that age. And I was just so beat up and unable to really, you know, even the design of the house was designed for an able-bodied young person. You know, it's like one of those Philly like row homes, and it was like three stories. So it's just like, you know, you're just climbing a mountain anytime you want to get up to the bedroom, basically.
Right.
And I just, you know, I spent a lot of time on the first floor sitting on the couch. And, you know, my mom came to Philadelphia and, you know, she cooked for me and took care of me.
What did she make?
In those ways. you know, that's the thing. I don't remember so much of what she made. It was just the fact that she was there.
Yeah.
Did your mom cook food from Barbados, from her country?
Oh, now we're talking. Now,
all
let
right.
me tell
Let's
you.
Hear.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So there are other things that, you know, that my mom cooked that brought about really warm memories for me. The most impactful is what we've already spoken about. But, you know, at Christmas time during the winter holiday season, my mom will used to make coconut bread, which is from, you know, from the Caribbean, from Barbados, or the West Indies in general. So it would be, you know, she would knead the dough and everything herself, make it from scratch, and then it would have like, you know, shaved coconut, and it would have raisins in it.
Oh yeah.
And it'd just be this really delicious bread that she made, and I would pretty much flip out for that every year. And just, I remember the smell of her cooking it in the house, and I can't remember if I got to experience that, because I mean, I think Zara, our accident was December 6th of 2006, or December 2nd?
December 3rd, my mother's birthday.
December 3rd. Okay, yeah. Right. Okay, right in there.
Yeah.
So you know, Christmas wasn't too far off. But yeah, you know, I just remember the comfort of that. She also made this thing called rum cake, where like it's like this dark cake, and you know, typically they have like the rum that's produced in Barbados is called Cockspur rum. Ooh. And you know, you soak the cake in the rum, and like it's just this dark cake, and it has some fruit in it. I just remember the texture and the smell.
Ooh,
like, so you know, so this is really comforting things. But I think that, rather than me necessarily channeling these memories, these particular memories, during tough times or during that particular tough time, I think that it's just the fact that I had those experiences that give me an overall makeup as a human being,
right,
that allow me to, you know, to find a steady energy, even in the midst of chaos, where I can find a way to cope. You know, it's like okay, if I can't emotionally cope with this, I'm gonna talk with people about it. If I'm sick of talking, I'm gonna sit and I'm gonna really think. And a lot of time, you know, when I have some quiet time to myself, my thought processes can be very productive for me.
You know how to find equilibrium.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and I think lately for me, you know, with especially with a lot of stuff I'm doing professionally with real estate, it's this, you know, this constant self-education. So I have, you know, a place of peace in terms of like listening to audiobooks or but I think that it all comes from audiobooks and podcasts, I should say.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It all really comes from that grounding of those experiences, right, as a kid, and you know, those Saturday morning experiences, those holiday experiences, or like when my cousin Jackie and my cousin Jennifer would come over from Barbados and stay with us, just like smelling them making roti, like, because I didn't get to eat roti regularly, you know, which
roti is so good.
It's so good, you know, and just like, you know, smelling them making real authentic, like, so it's basically like, it's like the Caribbean form of a burrito. So basically it's like you have, I couldn't tell you what all the ingredients are, but like for me, it was always, you know, my cousin Jackie would make curry chicken, and you know, she just would make a delicious batch of curry chicken. And then the roti is basically like the shell that you're, it's like the doughy shell that you're going to wrap all of the food in. So you're going to have like curry chicken and rice and probably some peas or something like that, peas and rice or whatever, and wrap that up. And then I want to say that the shell itself has a flavor. I don't know if it's seasoned with like cumin. I'm not sure. I can't, like, I would have to ask my mom. Can't remember, but
it has
just
some kind of thing in it, the bread part.
Allspice.
It does.
Maybe allspice, because allspice is a spice of the Caribbean.
It's very good.
There you go. Delicious. There you go.
It's delicious. We'll investigate. But ask your mom and then let us know and we'll. But yeah, I really like that look at it, because I feel the same way. You know, like, I do have a happy place, but I don't necessarily think of it when I need to get through something. But it's a great way of looking at it. Just like having had really solid, like, emotional experiences, I feel like there's hope. I mean, it gives us hope. It's like, well, life can be dark, but actually this also exists, right? Is that kind of how you feel, Jeff?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's like our foundation. It's this indelible part of us that, again, it's so much of a part of us. We have the luxury of like looking past it or not even realizing that it's at work, you know, at times of need, but it's definitely there, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So a question that we ask basically everyone as we're nearing the end of an episode is, if you could give yourself one piece of advice at the beginning of this process, right, when everything first happened, knowing kind of everything you know now, what would that be?
My thing is, always pay extra special attention to detail, even if you have people around you nagging you and calling you things like anal, you know, like, pay attention to the details, you know, you know, ask the non-sexy questions about extra insurance coverage and don't be too trusting of people around you that, simply put, I had people around me at that time that viewed me as a commodity and not so much as a person. So they were going to equip me with whatever I needed to go out and earn money, and not so much what I would need to be my best self, to be protected at the highest level in case of any crisis.
Yeah.
You know, and you realize, I mean, nowadays, you know, my whole thing is I find good people and I keep them around me. You know, in my real estate business, you know, there's no one that I work with that I wouldn't invite into my house to break bread with me. And it's so important to me. You know, you find good people, you keep them, you don't let go. You have a disagreement, you find a way to work it out. You don't say anything that's going to irreparably damage the relationship. You know, if you start to get to that point and things are getting heated, you take a break. You say, hey, let's talk about this some other time.
Yeah.
You know, I keep good people around me because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's like, I consider myself a strong person. I consider myself a person with a good heart that wants to do good things, genuinely wants to do good things for people. But you must also keep people around you that are well-intentioned, that can help protect your good-natured spirit, you know, and also fuel you to be an even better version of yourself.
Totally. 100%.
Yeah, and so I am. I keep my eyes very, very well peeled to examine people's character if they're going to be around me or if they have the potential of being around me. And I very quickly nowadays weed out the people that shouldn't be in my circle.
That's incredible.
Good advice.
It's incredible advice. And before we go, I just want to say thank you because I know that you have a complicated guilt and just complicated feelings, which maybe includes guilt, as you mentioned before.
Yeah.
This. But I want to say thank you because even though the process was really arduous and complicated and confusing, and you know, it led me to open my restaurant, which also was complicated and confusing, but ultimately amazing, you know, mm-hmm. and gave me a whole new life in food. And so, mm-hmm. you know, from that is really a huge reason why we even started the show. And then through starting the show, we're now able to reach so many people who are wrestling with all different kinds of food and grief issues and grief issues mostly, and access, mm-hmm. you know, disarm it through talking about food, which is the common bond that we all have, and being able to have these really open conversations. And I just want to say none of those things would have ever happened to me if not for that accident. And I'm not happy that we got in an accident by any means, but that is the silver lining for me in my own life. And so it turned out to be this incredible thing. And I see the work you're doing now with Thievery Corporation and the real estate business you've built. And I feel like a lot of good came out of a really traumatic, horrifying situation.
And you lived. Beautiful human beings.
And everybody lived.
Yes.
I think it's worth mentioning. Everybody lived.
Yes.
Yeah, which is just remarkable when you look, you know, when you look at the scene that from that night and what we were involved in, and the fire breaking out underneath the sleeping area and all of the electronic doors not working, it really is a miracle. And this is also, you know, why there is the saying that God works in mysterious ways. And I'm not the most religious, I don't really practice any particular form of religion. I just do realize that there's a higher energy out there than me, and I have a close relationship with that higher energy. Yeah. And, you know, it's these times where you just think like, oh yeah, this could be the end of my life. I could quite possibly never bounce back from this, or this is just so tragic. This is just going to ruin me. And, you know, not only in that situation, well, it's tough for me. You know, I think that for you, you have this more clearly defined turning point where you can say, hey, that actually was like the catalyst for some really positive things for your situation, Zara.
Sure.
For me, it was just this really curvy, windy road where I was then asked to put even more faith in the unknown.
Right.
As I just kind of like moved from place to place, following my heart in music and everything. But I do realize, you know, I've had more than one experience where when I thought I was my most down and out and that it could all be over, that was actually the beginning of me realizing something that would fuel my passion and my spirit for years to come. And I would want to say this just directly to everyone listening that is dealing with grief. It's like, you know, now is only now. Okay, so you're dealing with things and they feel like they've all piled up on you. They are weighing down on you. You know, I even talked with a buddy of mine yesterday, a guy that, you know, a brilliant guy that I work with. He's a heating technician. He's a plumber, you know, takes care of all my buildings. If I have a furnace go out, if I have a leaky anything, mm-hmm. this guy is brilliant. He's passionate about his work. Talking to me the other day, telling me that sometimes he thinks about ending it all.
Yeah.
And I said the same thing to him. I said, now is only now. You know, it's like if everything feels awful now, but if you can find a way to tap into anything within yourself that's going to get you to tomorrow, and then repeating that process and getting to the next day and getting to the next day, right. You're giving yourself the opportunity to turn things around, and things will inevitably turn around.
Yeah.
And so much of life is about your perspective on your situations. You know, there's people out there with perfectly fine lives who are pessimists, who are making every day seem, you know, every day seems terrible to them. You know,
totally,
seems like
right.
a dead end to them.
Totally.
And then there are people out there who are born with nothing, you know, two parents that don't love them or aren't around, or, or getting beaten or abused, and they make a decision, you know, I'm not going to live my life like this anymore. I want something better for myself. I want something better for my kids when I become a parent. And they, you know, there's just all types of scenarios. And my thing is just, you just cannot give up, you know, you just have to, you know, find a way to hold on, find a way to change your perspective, whether it's listening to podcasts, audiobooks, surrounding yourself with different people, you know, betting on yourself in some way, you know, taking a leap of faith. You know, I think we got to hang it in there, because there are rewards for being resilient. There are rewards for, you know, making honest efforts to better yourself, and for just hanging in there and having grit.
Right.
Totally. That is such a powerful, powerful message from such a wise, brilliant person. Mm-hmm. And you have always been a wonderful and beautiful friend and an inspiration to me. And I feel so blessed to have had, even be it traumatic experiences, just intimate experiences with you. And you are a lovely, deep, incredible person. And I know that we will be friends forever and ever, even if we go long periods of time without seeing each other. You're one of those people that will always be so tightly wound, so tightly knitted into the fabric of who I am as a person. And I love you.
That is the highest honor. And I love you too. And I'm very fully aware, even more so now, that I'm missing too much of your life.
Me too.
You know, so you know, at some point here, we gotta tighten this thing up a little bit. And you know, I mean, New York is not far away from where I live. I have to find a way to get myself.
Please do. Me too. Yeah, I want
to
be there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll have a reunion. Bobby, I would be happy to come to Rhode Island too, because I love fresh seafood. I'd love to join you for a plate of scrod.
That, you know what, I'm known to consume massive and unreasonable amounts of scrod. So
you know what we're naming this episode, don't you?
Broiled scrod. The scrod-isode. Scrodgate.
Scrodgate.
Can you actually quickly just tell our listeners where to find you, follow you, what you're working on?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, you can find me on all forms of social media as Mr. Lif, MR.LIF. But if you're going to specifically go to Instagram, I'm at the real Mr. Lif, MR.LIF. And, you know, I think that, where can you find me? Well, you can find me there, sure. I'm not one to spend a ton of time online posting. But when I do, I just try to make it count. You know, nowadays it's just like, you know, I have a new album that's finished, that's going to come out on Mellow Music Group this year. It's called Return of Colossus. And it's
awesome.
It signifies the fact that it's the 20-year anniversary of my debut EP, which was called Enters the Colossus.
I love Enters the Colossus. It's one of my favorite EPs.
Thank you
it's
so much.
Short but sweet. It's amazing. All
thank
right.
you so much.
Awesome. This is so exciting. Oh, wait, did you have something else?
And Zara, yeah, I will also just say that my real estate investment company is called the People's Trust Investment Group. It's an LLC based out of Rhode Island. I specialize in Providence, Pawtucket, and Central Falls. And really, you know, it's just something that I love doing with my loved ones, with people that I have close friendships with, or that are actual family members, partnering to purchase and develop real estate that will be around long after, you know, we're gone, to just, you know, make life more comfortable for us in the immediate future, and also to leave something after we're gone.
Totally. So smart. I respect it so much. I'm really inspired by you, actually. It's something that, as I become a real adult, even though I'm already 36, that I would like to try to do more of myself. Good investments.
Wonderful. Well, you can pick my brain anytime, Zara. I love talking real estate, and you know, so you'll have to tell me when to stop talking, because I have a lot to say about it. There you go. Love y'all.
Love
Thank you
too.
So much.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by New York Mutual Trading, the premier Japanese food, alcoholic beverage, and restaurant supply specialist. Mutual Trading is the Japanese food authority, true to the heart in upholding genuine Japanese food traditions, and progressive in exploring new ways to provide innovative restaurant supplies and services. They import, export, distribute, and manufacture the top brands for retailer and food service customers nationwide. Learn more at nymtc.com.
So that was a very special episode for me particularly. All the episodes we do are amazing, obviously. Love every guest in such a different way. But Jeff and I went through something so intense together, and to kind of be able to process it, you know, we haven't talked about that accident in that kind of way since it happened. And that was 13 years ago, 14 years ago almost now. How did it feel for you talking about that?
Well, I was literally shaking as he was describing the accident and you were describing it, because it really tapped into old trauma memories that I haven't accessed since it happened.
Yeah. So he joined us by phone, and, you know, so it's a little different than we were normally very focused visually on the guest. And I saw you kind of looking down, and for a minute, I have to admit, I was like, oh, she can't even pay attention to this part. This is the craziest thing that happened in my life. And then I realized that you were processing
deeply,
the remembering
deeply processing
the trauma.
Yeah. What happened.
Yeah. So I was completely wrong as to what you were going through. But just, you know, a couple things we try to do, and I guess this little outro part, is to bring some kind of connection with food and some kind of levity. And something that I really, really loved about the episode, aside from how much we talked about broiled scrod, which was hilarious. I don't even know what scrod. What is scrod? Is it like cod, but worse? How could it get worse than cod? I don't like cod very much. There's a lot of worms in it. But I loved when he was talking about the memory of his family making breakfast. And I love it because it really speaks to something that I truly believe in, which is that rich food memories that we have, and how food and the smell, when he was describing, just remembering the smells.
Right. They're part of our foundation.
It's part of our foundation, and it can be anything.
Yes.
Honestly, for me, right, and I'm a chef, and people always think chefs must have the fanciest taste. Probably one of my biggest food memories that can bring me back to any time is tomato soup, Campbell's tomato soup out of a can. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about it being fancy. It's not even about it being delicious to anybody else. It really can just be the smell. It can be a memory and a smell and a flavor that takes you back to a time when all this other stuff was happening.
That's,
you know,
right,
he's talking about these incredible cinematic kind, yes, of mornings with his family, his dad bringing back records and his mom is wrestling, and it's so cool.
It was great.
It was so great.
And just like we've heard from other guests of ours, that those simple food memories can be connected with good memories, but also they can be the strength getting through bad memories.
Yeah.
So it's both.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of, so I went to go visit Jeff in Boston one time, and I remember he took me to this like delicious sub sandwich shop. That's one of my only Boston food memories. And I visited him so many times, but that's one of the only
things. Well, I would like to add one more thing, that Zara, when you had those two surgeries, which was in San Diego, the thing that I remember most is that you and I, we had a convertible, and even though you're whole arm was in this full cast from fingertips to shoulder, and it had to stick out of the convertible.
Yeah,
and
I was on Percocet.
Right. We just traveled around and ate, and
we
had
did.
Scallops. We had fried scallops.
We did, and no scrod.
No.
Not a fleck of scrod to be found.
But eating during that difficult time was one of the ways that we brought balance.
Yeah.
As Jeff was talking about, we brought balance to a very difficult time.
Yeah, that's really true. And I remember him joining us at the house, at your house in Northport in Long Island, after he came and visited, and we shared a meal. I don't remember what it was, but I remember it was very sweet, and we all sat, yes, around and we all cuddled. He's, yeah, a cuddly friend.
Yes, he just always listening
used
to him.
We always used to cuddle together.
Yes.
You know, we never dated. It, yes, wasn't like a sexual relationship at all, but like we just always snuggled because he's,
well,
just
you
a
could feel
sweetie
his warmth
pie. He's
in,
a warm
in
person.
Interview.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really great. So thanks for everybody for listening. This was a really special one. And it's interesting. A lot of times we talk to people about, you know, somebody passed away and then this happened. And this was just so different. There wasn't someone that passed away, thank goodness.
Well, it was the loss of predictability.
Right.
And stability.
And realizing, I'm sorry to cut you off, but then realizing so fully how death is so real. That is when I, like, it changed everything for me. And, you know, not necessarily for better or worse, but like I'm intense. I want everything to happen immediately, right? And it's totally because of that. And, yeah, sometimes that's good. I don't bullshit a lot. I don't play games. You know, when it comes to relationships, I'm not the kind of person that's going to be like, oh, I'll wait a week to call. I'm like, no, I'll call you now because I could just die tomorrow. You, mm-hmm, know what I mean? So, right. And sometimes that works.
It was
and sometimes
a true near-death experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all held the trauma of it. And thank you, listeners, for letting Zara and I and Jeff process a trauma that was very significant in our lives.
Yeah, it really was. For everybody in a different way. I can't imagine on your end being a mom and going through that, and it was so weird. I was having this recovered memory, which I think I've talked about at some point before, but when you were talking about getting in the hospital, I remember I was so messed up, like, and on so many drugs, and I had been in this really traumatic, very physically taxing accident. And I remember I got transferred to UCLA, and like, I thought I was a car being worked on in an auto body shop.
That's what the drug studio.
Yeah, it was really weird. Anyway. Okay, guys. Well, thanks for tuning in, and we love you. And I hope that this episode was as interesting for you to listen to as it was for us to kind of re-experience and process.
So, thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.